This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. This week, Governor Rick Snyder said the low water levels on the Great Lakes have become an emergency, and he's ready to do something about it.
There's going to be a need to do some, what I would describe as emergency dredging, to make sure we keep it open for commerce, for tourism, for many other issues, and that's something we need to be discussing.
That news was welcomed by many coastal communities struggling to keep their harbors open. But at this point, the problems can't be solved with just dredging equipment. That's why pressure is mounting to do something at the St. Clair River, the place Lakes Huron and Michigan empty into the lower lakes. We'll hear about that this hour and take your calls about the low water levels. But first, to get a sense of the distress some communities are in, there's no better place to look than the Lacheno Islands. The chain of more than 30 islands is about 20 miles to the northeast of the Mackinac Bridge. The channels and bays there are a boater's paradise, and colorful boathouses dot the shoreline. But these days, the water is choked with weeds, and many of the iconic boathouses are on the beach. Bob Dunn runs a dock service in Cedarville. He says there are more than 200 boathouses among the Lacheno Islands.
Unless we really get a tsunami of weather the rest of the winter, I would guess 30 to 40% of those 200-plus boathouses, which could equate to as many as 80 of the 200, will be high and dry, totally unusable. And so in our business, we offer permanent docks and also a seasonal dock that it's kind of a pain, but it's the only way to get around this low water crisis. We put a post and stake dock in the spring, and then in the fall after Labor Day, pull it back out. And there's going to be a lot of that type activity. In some cases, it may require putting in a seasonal dock that's in excess of 100 feet.
Are people moving their boathouses? Are they permanently re-engineering their waterfronts to match the lower lake level?
In some cases, they are. It's a costly process to lift the boathouse up enough to be able to move it. And then we put, in our case, we use the old-fashioned dock, the cedar crib dock. We put new cribs lakeward of the existing. And then once we've got everything level and intact, then roll the boathouse onto the new structure. However, the state of Michigan, submerged lands people, they don't like to issue permits to go lakeward with permanent structures. They consider that an excessive use of state-owned bottomland. Me, personally, I've been through this several times with the state. They give that same speech. No, we're not going to allow it. Excessive use of bottomlands. Dredge. Dredge, baby, dredge. And I've consistently taken a position with the state DNDQ or DNR, whatever they are currently, that dredging, in my opinion, is more harmful to the environment than allowing a riparian landowner to go out into natural deep water with their structure.
Now explain how the low water levels are causing more plant growth.
Well, low water, it allows more sunlight to penetrate closer to the bottom. The lower the water, the more radiant the sun is on the bottom, and then that nurtures the root growth to grow at an accelerated rate. I think most of our weeds come in, they relate to commercial shipping, these ocean-going vessels that dump their ballast waters in our lakes, and they're full of seeds of this or that that are not native to this area. The main culprit right now and has been for 5 years, is Eurasian water milfoil, which came in on a foreign vessel from Asia, I assume, maybe Europe. And it slowly got into our waters. That weed is very cancerous, in effect, that vessels, we go out of our harbor, we're in this thick growth, we can't really run our boat with the weeds that have wrapped on our props, so we go out to the Federal Channel, which is 7-8 feet deep, reverse our props hard to release any weeds we've picked up, and then take off to our destination. The weeds that reverse off our prop quickly go to the bottom, start new growth. Or the weeds that didn't come off the propeller travel with that vessel, and they take those weeds home with them. When they do a similar reverse action to the propulsion system, it reverses small clippings of that growth onto the bottom, which in some cases is clean, virgin sand. And within a few years, you see a rapidly increasing plume of weeds growing and growing and growing and increasing in volume.
And so is this starting to cut into people's property values? Is lakefront property worth less these days because of the low water?
I think that's going to be the factor this year. But property values have been in decline since the recessionary era began in 2007, 2008, where a $100,000 property inland was maybe as near as a year ago was selling for $60,000. So property values had depreciated as of last summer to plus or minus 40%. Now you add in the low water, maybe you have a $300,000 cottage on 150-foot shorefront lot, and part of that valuation is because of the shorefront footage and the depth of water 50 feet out from the shoreline. And if there's no water out 50 feet, then maybe that water, now we're finding it at 150 feet out, which requires a larger structure to be built or an existing structure to be added onto. So the property looks less valuable to the proposed owner, and he makes a lower offer. And I would guess something that was selling 2 years ago when it was marginally low water, what was selling at $300,000, I'm going to take a guess that it would be worth $200,000 or less with the things they will have to do to access deep water. And when I say that valuation, I'm including the excessive weed growth infestation that it makes that property less desirable. Kids can't swim in these weeds. They're too thick. Some areas they're choking off this fish spawning. So it's going to play havoc on many issues.
Well, Bob, thanks for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Peter.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's Bob Dunn. He runs a dock service in the Leshino Islands. Bob is part of a coalition called Restore Our Water International. The group wants Canada and the U.S. to take action to restore some of the lake level on Lakes Huron and Michigan. Mary Muter is directing that work and is also with the Sierra Club in Ontario, and she joins us by phone. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Peter.
Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
So what does it mean to say, as Restore Our Water says, that Lakes Michigan and Huron are losing 10 billion gallons of water each day through the St. Clair River?
That number is basically because people always want to quantify this into some kind of value that means something. Because just telling them that the St. Clair River flow outflow has increased by 10% doesn't necessarily help people to understand what this means. So that's how that number got translated, based on the flow down the St. Clair River.
And how? What? Why is the outflow? I mean, rivers. That's what rivers do. Is they flow out, right?
That's right. That's correct. But the St. Clair River, unlike all the other connecting channels on the Great Lakes, has undergone over 100 years of alterations that have increased the outflow through the St. Clair River. And that includes sand and gravel mining way back in the early 1900s. It includes four sessions of navigation deepening, dredging in the St. Clair River. Many, many times, compensation measures have been designed, approved, money appropriated. The most recently, 1962 dredging that took place was conducted under an agreement between both our countries, and a condition of that agreement was that compensation measures be placed in the St. Clair River. The U.S. Army Corps was authorized, funding was provided, they began the process to place submerged sills, or a more easily understood word would be speed bumps, on the bottom of the St. Clair River that would reduce, slow the flow of the river.
And why has that not gone forward?
That's the really good question here, and I'm embarrassed to say, as a Canadian, what happened. The Canadian government bickered with the U.S. government over the hydraulic impact of those submerged sills. And after 10 years, Congress eventually withdrew the funding for those structures. So, unfortunately, you know, they were probably talking about half an inch difference, because at that point, they were going to restore Michigan Huron level by about 6 inches. The benefits that we would have of that today are huge, because they would have figured out to have some better monitoring of the outflow. Our governments have ignored it until I phoned the U.S. Army Corps in 2000 and said, how deep is it at this Blue Water Bridge at Sarnia and Port Huron? And they said, oh, we don't really know. We haven't done any bathymetry work there for 30 years. And they called me back and said, we didn't know it was that deep. Would you like us to find historic profile? And I said, that'd be interesting. And then they called me back and said, we found one, but it's not at the exact same location. Would you like us to redo it? And I said, yes, I think we need to understand what's happening there. And lo and behold, there was this increase. The river had deepened significantly. And basically, after a $17 million study, the IJC's Upper Lake Study Board confirmed, yes, there is erosion taking place in the St. Clair River. It's a result of a combination of human activities that have taken place there, including the dredging. We think it more than justifies compensation. None of the other lakes have had these kind of changes taking place. When the Seaway was originally designed, they put locks and control gates for Lake Superior, Lake Ontario. They designed them for the St. Clair River. That's what they originally intended to do. We don't need locks or control gates. In fact, we don't want them, and a lot of people would oppose that. The much more cost-effective and environmental responsible approach is to place these submerged sills or speed bumps on the bottom of the river.
Let's go back to the problem here so we can understand this a little better. So the riverbed has been mined for gravel, as you say. It's been dredged so that ships can get in and out of it.
Right.
Generally, the documents I've looked at, it is described that the effect of that lowers the levels of lakes Michigan and Huron by a certain amount, depending on who you ask, somewhere maybe as high as 20 inches, maybe less. But when you say we're losing 10 billion gallons of water a day, it sounds as though the lakes are draining out through the river.
Slowly, that is correct. The way you can tell what's happening here, we have all been, all of the lakes have suffered under the impacts of climate change. Over the past couple of years, we've had dry, warm winters with less ice cover that allows evaporation to take place throughout the winter. So all of the lakes are low. But right now, Lake Michigan and Huron is about 29 inches below its long-term average. The other lakes are much closer to 10 inches below their long-term average. So in other words, Michigan Huron is about three times as much below its long-term average as the other lakes. Plus, we have been hovering near this record, now setting record low levels, for now 13 years. That hasn't happened on any of the other Great Lakes. It's clearly pointing to a problem in the St. Clair River.
A problem that continues to exacerbate itself, you're saying?
That's correct.
And if I understand, there was a report done by the study board appointed by the International Joint Commission, and this is a commission, a binational commission of Canadians and
right.
Americans who are in charge of managing the treaty that the two countries have to manage the lakes. If I understand what the study board said, they do not agree that this is a problem that continues to worsen. They're acknowledging that the dredging in the St. Clair River has resulted in lower lake levels in Michigan and Ontario, but they assert that the river is fixed now and it's a lower level, but it's not going any lower because of human activity.
We're pleased. They did identify erosion that took place between 1986 and 2000. Since 2000, the water levels have not shown any sign of increasing. And more recent work by the coastal consulting engineering firm that did the original work to determine that changes in the St. Clair River were increasing the outflow, W.F. Baird and Associates, did some additional work and have determined that between 2000 and 2010, some significant change happened in the St. Clair River that again increased its outflow. I think the study board was premature in arriving at that conclusion. There was a massive ice jam in the St. Clair River the winter of 2007. I was standing beside the river as a U.S. icebreaker and a Canadian icebreaker plied their way up and down the river, trying to open up the river because some ship wanted to get through. But as fast as they went through the river, because of the pressure of the water coming down that very fast-moving channel, the ice was piling up in layers behind the ship. And, I mean, I'm talking about three and four layers deep because you could see it as the ship churned through the ice. Those layers of ice forced the water to dig down deeper. Has anybody done the assessment of what the impact was of that major ice jam through the entire length of the St. Clair River? And we know that at that time, Lake St. Clair levels just plummeted. So there was obviously a restriction to the flow that eventually was released. And, you know, the ice did eventually flow through. But, you know, in the interim, what happened to the St. Clair Riverbed? I think we need to understand this better. We don't have adequate monitoring. All the other Great Lakes have hourly measurements of the flows in the connecting channels. They have control boards that set monthly discharge rates. We have nothing like that for this huge body of water, Michigan Huron. And only under pressure from our group, we said, where are the flow meters in the St. Clair River? They didn't have one at the Blue Water Bridge, where the flow is the fastest, the river is the deepest. USGS finally placed a flow meter there. It only reads two-thirds the way of across. And I said to them, well, the Canadian government, how do you figure out what the rest of the flow is? Oh, we extrapolate. And I said, you extrapolate. Isn't that just a nice word for estimate? Well, the answer was yes. We need to have a much better understanding of what's happening in the St. Clair River. It is just too important a connecting channel. Compensation measures were placed in the Detroit River to maintain levels on Lake St. Clair around 1972. The project just didn't proceed into the St. Clair River. It's time now to act. We are slowly draining Michigan, Huron, and Georgian Bay. But, I mean, worse than that, the regulations for Lake Superior were changed in 1972, where they are supposed to address downstream conditions. Well, if you look at what's happened to Lake Superior since they started using those control regulations, they are now drawing down Lake Superior in a vain attempt to try and address low water level conditions downstream. We think that's wrong. We think that Lake Superior, as the headwaters of the Great Lakes, should be maintained in its best interests, and we need some ability to control the outflow of Lakes Michigan and Huron. But we do not need locks or control gates. We're not talking about billion-dollar structures here. We're talking about maybe $100 or $200 million split between both countries, spread out over several years.
So go back to Lake Superior and explain in a little more detail what you're saying and how the control of Lake Superior might be or is affecting Lakes Huron and Michigan.
The surface area of Lake Michigan, Huron, and Georgian Bay is greater than the surface area of Lake Superior. So if you draw down Lake Superior 1 inch in an attempt to try and address Michigan Huron low water levels, you only raise Lake Michigan Huron levels something more than half an inch. And it's just, you know, so you just have to keep drawing down Lake Superior to try and raise Michigan Huron levels. It's irresponsible. The control gates in the St. Mary's should go back to what they were originally designed for, which was to maintain the waters in the headwaters of the Great Lakes.
So these compensation measures in the St. Clair River, speed bumps, mm-hmm. as you referred to them earlier, they don't sound terribly expensive. My sense is everyone agrees they would have some effect, although how much perhaps might be disputed. Why are you optimistic that the International Joint Commission, when it comes forward this month, will advocate moving ahead on at least studying these more or even advocate putting them in?
No, not really very optimistic about that. Dareth Glance, the U.S. Commissioner, spoke at a recent meeting in Chicago and mentioned then that they were going to be recommending an adaptive management strategy going forward. Adaptive management is those kind of concepts are good ideas facing climate change, but we need something more than that. And I would suggest that putting speed bumps in the St. Clair River is an adaptive management structure. We know that climate change will take its toll, probably the most significantly on Michigan, Huron, Georgian Bay because of the loss of ice cover. We need some ability to control the levels and to balance the amount of water that's in all of the Great Lakes responsibly. Right now we have control boards that meet monthly, the Lake Superior Control Board, the Niagara River Control Board, the St. Lawrence River Control Board, and nothing for this huge body of water. So the bottom line is, no, not optimistic about that. I am optimistic, though, that the U.S. Army Corps believe that they do have authorization under that agreement that both countries signed a long time ago. And if we can just get funding to move to the U.S. Army Corps so they could finally put in place the compensation measures that were designed, approved, agreed upon way back 50 years ago.
But as a practical matter, can you really imagine the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers with with the agency in Canada moving forward without the support of the International Joint Commission today, saying, oh, we had permission back in the 70s, we're going to go ahead and do this?
As a practical matter, yes, because if both countries come to an agreement on something like that, as they did for the Seaway when it was originally designed and approved, if both countries come to an agreement on that, the IJC does not have to be involved. They could simply provide some oversight. The IJC has authority to act if there is a dispute, but in this case, if our countries simply agreed, that agreement is still valid, let's move on. No, the IJC would not have any responsibility then, except if our countries ask them to provide some oversight, like putting in place a Lake Huron, Lake Michigan outflow monitoring board, which is what we need. We don't need a control board.
And just one last question. You mentioned climate change. And the study group for the IJC reports that the climate change scientists have a different opinion these days about the Great Lakes. They don't expect dramatic lowering of the lakes as they once did. And the study board says that it expects the level of the lakes to stay in the historic range, in which we'd be at the bottom of that range at this point. What do you say to that?
Well, let me just clarify that. We are not at just the bottom of the historic range. We actually set a new record low for the month of December, and we're now setting a new record low for the month of January. And if things continue with the way they are, we'll probably set an all-time record low in a month or two. So we are outside of the historic range. And yes, there is a historic range for the other Great Lakes. It's basically flat lines, a high and low level range. But what historic range are they referring to? I would like to choose the historic range that existed on Michigan Huron from 1865 to 1920, before all of the navigation dredging took place. We have a fairly significant downward trend line when you put a trend line through from 1865 to 2012. That's not happening on any of the other Great Lakes. Yes, keeping them within the historic range before dredging took place, we would agree with that, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the best we can probably get here is to compensate for the 1962 dredging, stabilize the riverbed to stop the erosion, and then have an outflow monitoring board that would properly measure and assess the outflow and balance the amount of water in all of the Great Lakes in a coordinated fashion, instead of having these independent control boards with basically ignoring everything that's happening on Michigan Huron and Georgian Bay.
All right. Well, Mary, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Mary Muter. She's with the Sierra Club in Ontario and also is directing Restore Our Water International, a group that is advocating for these structures to be built, sills or weirs, as they're sometimes referred to, or speed bumps in the St. Clair River to stop or restore some of the water level that has been lost because of dredging and other human activity in the St. Clair River. You're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm joined now by Peter Annan. He wrote the book Great Lakes Water Wars, and these days he is directing Notre Dame's Environmental Change Initiative. Good morning, Peter.
Morning, Peter.
Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
And let me tell our listeners, we have a phone line. It's a little different than usual. The number this morning, if you want to join in this conversation with a comment or a question, is going to be 231-276-4412. And that's just a straight phone line. It's not our usual system. So it might be busy if you call. But that is the number we have, 231-276-4412. So, Peter, you would have a word of caution for anyone who proposes tinkering with human engineering with the lake levels. Lay out some of the concerns you would want people to understand well.
Yeah, well, it's really important to realize that, you know, the only, really the two main lakes left in the system that aren't manipulated by man are Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. Lake Erie is well, sort of falls slightly into that category. But the main two lakes that are really natural, that very naturally left, are Lakes Michigan and Huron. And so what that means is that the lakes can vary, according to the historical record over the last 150 years or so, by 6 vertical feet. So if you live on a cliff, and there you have property on the Great Lakes so that's cliff-like, which we do have in several areas, then the water level is going to drop by you know, 6 vertical feet. But if you're like most people, you go to the beach, it's a gradual sloping beach, it could be 150 yards, say, from where the water level is today during this period of low water levels to, you know, where the water level was when you know, I was a kid, say, for example. And so for humans, this is really aggravating. And particularly low water levels, people go to the beach and they see these low water levels and they think, gosh, something is seriously wrong. And if you're a marine operator, like the marina operator you had on earlier in the show, et cetera, those low water levels, your dock can be standing high and dry today, and you have to chase the water levels back and forth, et cetera. And if you're a shipping company, for every inch that water levels drop in the connecting channels, like the St. Clair River, say, for example, then they have to often, during the low water periods, remove cargo from their holds to so that the ship doesn't list so far down in the water, which sort of creates water level inflation for the cargo throughout the Great Lakes region. So impact steel prices, coal prices, et cetera, et cetera. That's the human side. Let's look at it from the environment of the Great Lakes side, which is that this natural variability has been part of the ecosystem, you know, for many, many years, you know, thousands of years, and that the lakes have evolved with this natural variability. And so what happens is these water levels go down, and you have this 50, 150 yards of mudflats been exposed, and those are seed banks, often for rare plants that all, that bloom under these, you know, long-term cycles. There's a little bit of controversy in the scientific community, but roughly there's been this 30-year cycle from high to high or low to low. We only have about five revolutions of that 30-year cycle. So some scientists say, look, five iterations isn't enough for me to make a case that there truly is a 30-year cycle. We need more data. But a lot of scientists believe that there's this 30-year cycle in the data. And you know, if you go back and you look at the all-time high was 1986, and then we went into this period of low water levels around 2000. We're still in that period of low water levels, and we should be coming out of it fairly soon. But if you go back to these mud flats, you know, you get rare plants that come out, and a lot of times when these low water levels first come, you have people crawling around in these plants, and that's because they're botanists trying to find rare Great Lakes plants that they have only seen in a textbook. And then those areas vegetate, and people have to walk through vegetation now to get to the water, and it can be, you know, a drag. But these vegetated areas become stopover areas for neotropical migratory birds, nesting areas in some cases, and then always over time, these water levels have come back up. They've inundated that vegetation. That vegetation, that terrestrial vegetation, starts to deteriorate, and then it, you know, becomes a nursery for young fish, and then eventually that terrestrial system is overtaken by an aquatic system, again, on this 30-year cycle. And so this is all part of the natural system in the Great Lakes Basin. And humans, again, are frustrated because they would love water levels to stay doggone at the same all the time, because that means my dock is always in the right place, my boathouse is always in the right place, etc. But these are natural systems. They're not pools that we can, you know, manipulate to our will, and that's the perspective I think that's important to keep in mind, particularly during these low water periods.
But someone arguing, I mean, the term compensation suggests that some water has been taken away through the St. Clair River and it should just be restored. What do you think of that assertion?
Yeah, so that, and that's a really important perspective as well. So let's put it in a perspective that I think your listeners can really understand. You know, the most controversial water diversion in the Great Lakes region by far is the Chicago diversion, which reversed the Chicago River in 1900 and sent 2.1 billion gallons every day from Lake Michigan to the Gulf of Mexico. Every day, 2.1 billion gallons that should remain in the Lake Huron, Michigan system and flow out the St. Clair Rivers flowing the other way. According to the International Joint Commission, that dropped water levels on Lakes Michigan and Huron by 2 inches. 2 inches. The most controversial diversion in the Great Lakes region dropped water levels on Michigan and Huron by 2 inches. As you were discussing with Mary Muter earlier in the show, if you go back and you look at the St. Clair River, which is like a drain in the Lake Huron bathtub, and in the early part of the last century, there was gravel mining, sand mining, and then a series of navigational dredges. According to the Corps of Engineers, that combination of mining and dredging on the bottom of the St. Clair River dropped water levels on Lake Michigan and Huron from the, you know, a range of 14 to 16 inches, a huge change in the natural system. That's a permanent drop. There was some confusion, I think, earlier part in the show. That just lowers the water level by, so you got 2-inch drop from the Chicago diversion. You've got a 14 to 16 inch drop from this dredging in the St. Clair River. But it's important to, when, and at the top of the show, you talked about the governor wanting to dredge marinas. That's a different thing. Dredging marinas so that boats can get in and out during low water levels is one issue. Dredging connecting channels is a whole nother ball of wax, and any manipulation to a connecting channel is really a big deal because history has shown it can have really significant implications on the overall water levels in the Great Lakes. So I think that most people would agree that restoring some of that damage to the bottom of the lake, bottom of the river, so that it would sort of reclose up part of that drain at the Lake Huron bathtub back to where it would have been pre-1917, say, for example, and to restore a little more than a foot of water level to Lake Michigan and Huron is what I think a lot of people would agree that's probably a sound approach.
Why do you think the study commission for the IJC was maybe ambivalent, you might say, toward this idea?
Yeah, and I don't know. I can't speak for the IJC. I do believe strongly in the IJC system. So it's an organization formed by the Canadian and U.S. governments in 1909 to study transboundary water issues all along the U.S.-Canada border, and they spend a lot of money and they hire a lot of great experts. But part of the issue in the IJC report is that they said that it's not, the issue isn't just the erosion and dredging that's occurred in the bottom of the St. Clair River. They basically said it's more complex than that, and we had other issues like climate. There's, you know, some evidence that climate change may be having an impact on Great Lakes water levels. And there's something called isostatic rebound, which is, you know, you go back, you have glaciers a mile high on the shorelines and on top of the Great Lakes, 18,000 years ago. Those glaciers melt 10,000 years ago. And actually, in some areas, there is a rebound still of the Earth's crust of, say, a centimeter per century in some areas. Well, if you think of the Lake Huron, say, as a soup bowl, in some areas that isostatic rebound is rebounding faster than other areas. And one of those areas where it's rebounding faster is in Georgian Bay. So you have the soup bowl maybe tilting up a little bit, and then you widen the drain in the bathtub a little bit, and all of a sudden you have, you know, a change in water levels. And, you know, Georgian Bay is not just one of the most beautiful places in the Great Lakes. It is an extraordinary gem for the world. 30,000 islands in Georgian Bay, and if people haven't ever been there, they should add it to their life list. And I feel for the people in Georgian Bay because, you know, you have people who have family cottages that have been in their families for generations, and they're now walking to their island cottages that they used to canoe to or boat to or whatever. And that is obviously very alarming and disturbing. However, again, if we look at the system from a human standpoint, doggone it, every 30 years we need to do something to change these lakes. But if you look at it from hydrogeologic time, I think we need to really look back at the history of the Great Lakes. They have traditionally rebounded. Sometimes they rebounded to the point in 1986 where houses were sloughing off into the lakes, and people are like, we got to get rid of all this water. And so to spend millions of dollars, you know, every few decades to study what's wrong, there's nothing wrong, in my view, with studying the lakes. We need to know more and more. I completely agree with Mary on that.
Okay,
going on with the lakes.
Let me jump in because we have a caller I want to bring on. Let me say I'm talking with Peter Annan. He directs Notre Dame's Environmental Change Initiative. We're talking about the low water levels on lakes Michigan and Huron and what could be done about that? And we have just one phone line today. So we're going to take a call. And when he's done, you can try and join in at 231-276-4412. And right now we have Roger in Sheboygan. Hello, Roger. You're on Points North.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I guess my comment in question to Mr. Annan is you're being very overt about talking that water level fluctuation is a natural variability, and water level fluctuations is something that we really should embrace because of the ability for nature to restore itself. And I fully agree with that. But how can you actually try to explain that Michigan Huron is a natural system when over 100 years or better, the mean monthly water level has been dropped by anywhere from 16 to 20 inches? And then you look at Lake Superior, where the water surface elevation, the average elevation, has increased by a half a foot. And correspond that with Lake Ontario, where its long-term range was reduced by half by the regulation. None of these systems are natural any longer. And it's not a question of tinkering. It's a question of wholesale change in the natural range.
Okay.
So I'd like them to respond.
Okay, thanks. And we're going to have to take you off the air for your answer. Go ahead, Peter.
That's a great question, and Roger's obviously done his homework. And so there's a few things that hasn't come up yet that Roger flicked at, and I like to get at them. So the entire system is interconnected. So when you control the water levels on Lake Superior, then you manipulate in a sort of a backward way the water levels on Lakes Huron and Michigan downstream and Lake Erie. And if you control the water levels, you know, on Lake Ontario, then you're manipulating the water levels downstream for the St. Lawrence River, for example. And so he's absolutely right that we're already we've manipulated the system so much that it is definitely a manipulated system by man. However, it's a lot more manipulated on Lake Superior, and it's a lot more manipulated on Lake Ontario than it is on Lakes Huron in Michigan. We still have, if you go back and you look at the historical record, this 6 vertical feet in natural variability, Michigan and Huron are the only lakes, and again, Lake Erie comes close, where that natural variability mirrors the natural variability that has been in the system for recorded time. That natural variability is gone from Lake Superior because humans, the Lake Superior Control Board that Mary talked about, manipulate it based on the various constituencies that they need to keep in mind, both on Lake Superior and downstream in Lakes Michigan and Huron. Lake Ontario is the most extreme example. There have been millions of dollars of studies and extensive controversy on Lake Ontario, oddly enough, that man is manipulating the water level there too much, and that wetlands no longer have this big natural variability that enriches them over time, et cetera. They've taken the big wiggle out of the bell curve, and they've flattened it out, so there's not their big swings, and it's become extremely controversial for the opposite reason on Lake Ontario, that there's too much manipulation of the system. It's not natural enough, and basically man is winning out over nature, and the IJC is controlling the water too much on Lake Ontario. I'm oversimplifying a very complicated debate on Lake Ontario, but it's interesting when you look from stem to stern in the Great Lakes Basin. And the IJC, trying to study and oversee and deal with controversies throughout, it's pretty ironic that at one end you have people complaining about too much manipulation, and at the other end you have people complaining about not enough.
But still, again, this proposal to put sills in the bed of the St. Clair River just sounds like a modest proposal given all the fluctuations that we have in view.
Yeah, again, I think most people would agree that any manipulation, whether it's sills or replacing the dredging and mining harm that was done to the bottom of the St. Clair River, I think most people would agree that sort of restoring that to what it was, bringing back that, 14 inches or so that has been permanently lost to the water level, is less controversial than anything that would, manipulate the water levels on a regular basis.
I have a listener who sent me an email wondering if the structures at the bottom of the river could be turbines and generate renewable energy.
That has been discussed, not by the IJC as far as I know, but there are some people who have suggested win-win solutions like that. Yeah, and it's a busy navigation channel, right? So you have to really worry about that. But that has been discussed. That's not the first time that idea came up.
And they're not talking about a dam.
Right, exactly. So there's the hydrokinetic energy was these basically underwater windmills or turbines. Some of them look like jet engines, and they just capture energy from the current that flows through them. Some move very slowly and generate energy through that way. Some move faster. A few years ago there was a flurry of activity about potentially putting these in a lot of major riverways throughout the United States.
All right, let's take another call. This is Lois in Traverse City. Hi, Lois. You're on Points North.
Yes, I just have a real basic question. I've lived along Grand Traverse Bay for over 37 years, and something I noticed this summer, right along East Bay, where I can walk on a daily basis, the water is a natural shoreline, and then right after Labor Day, literally right after Labor Day, it looked like in a matter of 2 or 3 days, somebody took a big old straw and the water went out way past where all the people have their docks out. All of a sudden, all that water was gone. That doesn't seem like something natural happened. We don't have tides here, but I just wonder what happened to that water and how can it go away so quickly? And I understand about the whole ebb and flow of nature, and I totally believe in that. We have a gem up here for the whole world, and I really don't think that mankind should be messing with that. It is our natural habitat, and we need to learn to live within that instead of trying to be greedy. Of course, mankind does likes to do the reverse, but I just wonder about that water.
So Lois,
what happened to it?
When you say we shouldn't meddle with it, would you is that to say you wouldn't support trying to repair some of the damage that has been done to the St. Clair River by dredging and mining?
If it's a good natural repair, I can understand that. But if it's to add more of mankind's mess, I don't agree with that. But if it will help to repair like we did with Lake Erie, then that's fine, yes. I just wonder where all that water went in a matter of, a week.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Peter, any thoughts about the quick drop we did see this fall?
Yeah, so I don't what it sounds like Lois is describing is a seiche, and we don't have real tides in the Great Lakes, but we do have seiches, and seiches tend to be related to major storm events. And what happens is you have this is really pronounced on Lake Erie, the shallowest of the Great Lakes. So you have a storm event. I'll use Lake Erie as an example. So you have a big storm event, low pressure that comes in, pushes down on the water on one end of the lake and pushes it way up on the other end of the lake. And so you can literally have seiches. I've seen photographs of this. Seiches in the islands of the western basin of Lake Erie push the water down so far that you can walk to some of those little islands or between some of those little islands in the western basin of Lake Erie, and the water goes way up, way high on the other end of the lake over by, say, Buffalo, for example. There have been some cases where the storm events have been so extreme that you've had people fishing on piers in the Great Lakes on one end, and then the big seiche comes and all that water comes and washes people into the lake. And so these are really rare. They're really unique. That I don't know exactly. I mean, they tend to come for a shorter period of time than several days, and then they tend to be much shorter than that, sort of the storm event kind of a thing, and then the water comes back. But my guess is, just a guess, that might be what Lois may have been experiencing during her walk.
Okay. And on this question of whether the problem is worsening in the St. Clair River, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I know Mary was talking about how we're definitely flirting with some records. We're bouncing around and have been for some time the lower end of the extreme for quite a while. I agree with her that if we're going to talk about the range, we should go back the pre-1920s when, or even 1900, when you know the first major manipulation in Chicago occurred. That would be really, I think, edifying to the general public to go back that far. And as Roger said, there have been a lot of manipulations we haven't even talked about, including major diversions into Lake Superior that more than compensated for the water that was lost out of the Chicago diversion. So anyway, to get back to your question, I think the key question now is if we're bouncing, if we really consistently start to break records, and not really monthly records, I mean these annual all-time lows is I think what we really need to start paying attention to. Because keep in mind, right, let's get back to the point that we were just talking about. The Lake Superior Control Board can control whether or not we break records or not. If we get really getting low to a record on Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, they can release more water from Lake Superior so we don't break a record. And if we get really close to a record on Lake Superior, and then we get really close to records on Lake Michigan and Huron to the point where the Lake Superior Control Board can't decide, essentially, whether or not we're going to break a record or not, and we're just down there really low throughout the Upper Great Lakes, then we have an issue that we really need to start paying attention to. But what's really complicating the debate now is climate change. And what we see with climate change is a potential to lower water levels in a significant way over time. And I know the IJC, you know, didn't think that was particularly serious, but other reports have suggested that it is. And so that's something for everybody to keep in mind as we go forward.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We'll have to pick that up in another show. So, Peter, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you. That's Peter Annan, author of Great Lakes Water Wars and the director of Notre Dame's Environmental Change Initiative. You've been listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. Thanks to Jack Connors and Neil Stino for helping me produce the show today. Tom Paulson is the general manager of Interlochen Public Radio. John Wunsch composed and performed our theme. I'm Peter Payette. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.